chirpers around our house in Sienzo, all chirping and dull brown feathers. The word doesn't seem to fit this silent, solitary girl, who is more like the cat that would stalk the birds before pouncing. After breakfast, Mistress Iara calls us for our first lesson. Lil prepares me carefully. She fixes my hair into a sleek double knot at the nape of my neck before dressing me in a fuchsia roomkin, a wrap front shirt with draped sleeves and a floor-length skirt, secured by a sash that falls down its front in a long-tailed bow. Apparently, it's another clothing style popular with Central Ikara's high-class clans. But I am stiff and self-conscious in it, even though the fabric is soft. "I'm not even leaving the house," I say as Lil fusses over the bow for a good few minutes. "Does it have to be perfect?" She shoots me a surprisingly stern look. "You're a paper girl now, mistress. You never know who you might run into, who is judging you at any time." Then she lightens. "You know, it's important you win the favor of the court if you want to win the Demon King's heart."
"Like he even has one," I mutter when she's out of earshot.
The other girls are already there when I arrive at Mistress Iara's suite. They're kneeling around a table with a stove set into the middle, steam rising from a copper kettle. On the walls are richly colored rolls of velvet and embroidered satin, all fluttering in the breeze coming in through the open doors at the back of the room. Through them, I glimpse the green of a courtyard garden, speckled with morning light.
"Leiji, what a beautiful outfit," Mistress Iara says with a smile. She motions to a space next to Aoki. "Would you like some barley tea? I know how you girls must be feeling after yesterday's assessments. There's nothing better for nerves." I kneel, careful to fold my skirt under the back of my leg so it won't fan out. Then, realizing what I'm doing, I let out a disbelieving laugh. Just a week ago, I was squatting in a mixing tub, covered in dirt. Manners and etiquette were the last things on my mind. Mistress Iara lifts a brow.
"Something amusing, Leiji?"
"Oh," I pick at the tails of my bow under the table. "I was just remembering something that happened earlier."
A few of the girls stiffen. They must be worried I'm going to bring up what happened in the bathing courtyard. But that's the last thing I want Mistress Iara to know about. I highly doubt fighting is on the list of skills a paper girl should cultivate.
"Oh, hey, King, check out my amazing whip kick."
"I keep tripping in my shoes," I make up lamely. Mistress Iara nods.
"Ah, yes. I remember. It took me a long time to get used to them, too."
She looks around the table, and even this, the simple sweep of her head, has an elegance to it. Precision.
"I don't know how much you all know about my heritage. Most of you are from prominent families. You've grown up with the customs of the court. But I spent my childhood working for my family's sari-making business in southern Kitori. When I first arrived at the palace, I was as graceful as a duck drunk on plum wine, heavens help me."
A few of the girls titter.
"No one would know, mistress,"
Blue says, her tone honeyed. "My father told me you were the king's favorite." Aoki lets out a cough that sounds suspiciously like a snort. Ignoring her, Blue continues.
"Didn't he personally choose you to become the paper girl mentor, so we could all learn to be like you?"
"Well, I'm not sure about that," Mistress Iara replies with a half-smile.
"But it's true, my transformation was pronounced.
It took a lot of hard work and dedication to prove myself. That's why I take my job as your mentor so seriously. Whatever your backgrounds, you start at the same level here. Madam Himura and I have organized a rigorous timetable of lessons. You'll be replaced by new girls next year, but you're still expected to work in the court as performers or escorts for the king's guests and so on. So it's important to keep cultivating your new skills. Just then, one of the girls speaks up.
Will we have any time off, Mr. Ciara? I have a cousin who works in city court. I promised my parents I'd visit her.
It takes me a moment to recall her name. Chenna, the dark-skinned girl who was wearing an orange dress, a sari, as Lil later explained, a style popular in the southern provinces, the night we arrived. Today, her sari is citrus yellow. It sets off the smooth gloss of her skin, the coal shade of her wide, heavy-lashed eyes. You'll have some time between your lessons and engagements with the court, Mistress Yara answers. But it's important for you, she turns to us, for all of you, to understand that you don't have free time to yourselves here in the palace. You can't just leave woman's court as and when you like. Her voice softens. Don't get me wrong. You can live very happy lives as paper girls, I assure you. I myself have. But we are all part of the rhythms and workings of the palace. And so we must play the parts expected of us. She begins a lecture on some of the palace's many rules and regulations. There are rules for things I wouldn't even have thought of, such as the depth of a bow, or the speed at which we should walk in different areas of the palace. Soon, she'll say we have to regulate our bowel movements too, I whisper to Aoki, who stifles a giggle. This is just an introduction, of course, Mistress Iara says once she's finished with the lesson, a full hour later. You'll learn everything else you need to know from your teachers in due course. But does anyone have any questions for now? Only about everything, but I don't admit it. I have one of the twins announces. After Mistress Yara nods, she leans forward and drops her voice a fraction. Is it true that there is a demon queen? Murmurs ripple through the room. Nonplussed, I glance at Aoki. She shrugs. It seems the two of us are the only ones who haven't heard of her before. Mistress Yara waits for quiet. Then she answers, yes. A pulse of expectant stillness falls over the table. Most people outside the palace aren't aware of her existence because she's hidden, kept in private quarters in royal court for the sole purpose of breeding. My father told me there is more than one queen, Blue says. Then he was misinformed, Mistress Iara answers, and Blue's face does a little spasm as she tries to look like she didn't mind being wrong. There is only one. The royal fortune tellers and advisors couple her carefully with each new king when he takes the throne, to ensure a union the heavens will smile upon. I swallow, glancing round the table. None of us could become the queen, could we? Certainly not, Mistress Yara replies. You are paper castes. It is impossible for you to produce the moon cast heir that would be required. In fact, each time you spend a night with the king, you will be given medicine to keep you from becoming pregnant. While I don't know much about intercaste procreation, I do know that although it is difficult for a man and a woman from different castes to conceive, especially a paper caste female and a moon caste male, it's still possible. I suppose the king wouldn't want to lose his concubines to miscarriages, or worse, give him a low-caste baby. In a coupling, the higher caste's gene is usually dominant, but we've all heard the stories of couples being taken by surprise.
Has the current queen given the king any children yet?
Chenna asks from across the table.
Blue's eyes go wide, and she shares a look with the short-haired girl sitting next to her.
Mistress Iara lifts a hand. That is a private matter between them, not to mention a sensitive issue. I strongly suggest none of you inquire into it any further.
She tilts her head, her face relaxing.
Let's eat. You must all be hungry. As lunch is served, we chatter easily at the table. Maids duck between us to keep our plates and cups full. Perhaps Mistress Iara's barley tea really does work, because halfway through the meal, my nerves have calmed, and I'm starting to enjoy the afternoon. The serene comfort of Mistress Iara's suite, the food, the company of the other girls. It's the first chance I've really had to get to know them. Besides Aoki, Blue, and Ren, there is Chenna, who I learn is from Jana's capital, Iazu, in the south and is the only daughter of a rich mine owner. I like her immediately. She comes across as reserved, though not shy. When one of the other girls asks her whether she misses her family, she says yes without hesitation. The twins are Jen and Jin. Their delicate features and alabaster skin are so similar I can barely tell them apart. I overhear them telling Chenna about their aristocratic family in Han, which, judging by her reaction, is apparently well known in Ikara. Of course it would be. Aristocratic paper caste families are rare. Enterprise and government are areas for moon castes. Even steels are mostly limited to industry and trade. Paper castes usually occupy the lowest roles, servants, farmers, manual laborers. Sometimes the caste lines are crossed. Jen and Jin's family, as well as Blue's and Ren's, are testaments to that. But it's uncommon. And still, there's always the knowledge that no matter how high a human might rise, demons will always be superior. The last in our group is Mariko, a curvaceous girl with full lips and a perfectly oval face, enhanced by cropped hair that cups her chin in two wing-like sweeps. Mariko and Blue seem to have become friends. They drop their heads together to whisper often, shooting me smug looks over the table. I get so fed up of this that the next time they cut their eyes to me, I beam back, waving. There's a snort. I glance round to find Ren watching me, her eyes lit with amusement. But as soon as she sees me notice, the smile drops from her face. She crooks her neck round, shoulders stiff. What's her problem? I ask Aoki under my breath, scowling in Ren's direction. She's barely said a word to anyone. It's like she wants us to dislike her. Aoki leans her head close. Well, you know what they say about the Hanos. At my blank look, she goes on. You know how most paper castes hate them for being so close to the king? She must be aware of that. I can't imagine it's easy. It takes me a moment to understand what she's telling me. That Ren may act like she hates all of us, but maybe it's because she's worried that we hate her. After lunch, Mistress Iara takes us out to her small courtyard garden. It's beautiful. The trees and bushes are strung with colorful beads, yellow flowers dotting the green like precious jewels. Gilded cages hang from the eaves. The twitters of the birds inside rise above the babbling pool that loops round a central island, mounted by a small pagoda. Something about the place reminds me of my garden back in Cienzo. The slightly overgrown edges, or maybe just the sound of birdsong and the warm sunshine on my face. Eyes stinging, I hurry away from the other girls, heading down a narrow stone path, suddenly wanting to be alone. I settle on a bench half hidden by a magnolia tree. Curling cups of pink-white leaves form a ceiling overhead. The afternoon air is rich and sweet, full of the scents of blossom and sun-warmed wood and the conversations of the other girls. I recognize the voices of Chenna and Aoki just around the corner.
"So you've heard about them too," Chenna says.
"I thought they were only happening in the north. There was one not far from where we live in the east of Shomu, and I heard reports of others in the rest of our province. Cienzo and Noe, too."
"I think it's all the periphery provinces. We've had some in Jana, too. My ama told me the king's patrols have always performed raids," Aoki replies, "especially on villages where paper caste clans live. But there's more now. And from what we hear, they're different. Even worse."
"Has anyone you know?" Chenna's voice trails off. I imagine Aoki shaking her head.
"You?"
"No, the court would never attack the capitals." There's a pause, and then Chenna goes on. "But on my way to the palace, we passed a town near the northern border, or what was a town. There was barely anything left of it. My mother told me she had a friend who had family there. Kuna help their souls," she blesses quietly.
"I saw places like that on my way here too,"
Aoki murmurs.
"Do you think it has anything to do with the sickness?"
"I don't know, but I do know that the sickness has been getting worse. My parents told me our taxes have gone up, and more of our crops are getting seized by royal soldiers every year. It must be getting pretty bad in some places."
They move away, and my thoughts drift with them. I don't know what the sickness is, but they were talking about the raids, like the one that happened to my village, and the ruined town I saw on my way to the palace. It must be happening all over Ikara.
"General Yu said the one we saw in Cienzo had to do with a rebel group. Is that why other places are being attacked too? And was that what he meant when he said to Mistress Iara that the kingdom is facing hard times? Increased rebel activity? And whatever this sickness is?"
"What do you think?"
Mistress Iara's voice surprises me from my thoughts. I hurriedly stand and give her a bow, which she waves me out of, smiling.
About the raids?" I ask, before realizing she doesn't know what I overheard Aoki and Chenna discussing.
"About my garden," she corrects with a frown. "Do you like it?"
I nod.
"It's lovely." She sits down on the bench, motioning for me to join her.
"I'm so glad you like it. Sometimes in summer, I sleep out here in the pagoda. It reminds me of my childhood. We used to do that too, when the weather was good."
"You said your family were sari makers from Kitori."
Mistress Iara nods.
"We were well known in the region. There was always lots of work. My cousins and I would tell jokes, exchange gossip as we washed in the river after work to get the dyes out of our skin."
She raises her palms and adds, muted,
"Sometimes I dream about being unable to get the colors out. When I wake up and find my hands bare, it almost makes me want to cry."
She lets out a little laugh and shakes her head. "I'm being nostalgic."
"Do you miss it?" I ask gently. "Your home?" There's a beat of hesitation before she replies.
This is my home now, Leiji. She lays a hand on my shoulder.
You should try to start thinking of it that way, too.
I look away. My home is Sienzo, I mutter.
My parents' house. It always will be.
Even after Mama was taken, Baba, Tien, and I kept it going. We made a new family. We kept our home alive. How can I just let go of that? I remember the promise I made to myself on the way to the palace. I won't let go of it. Whatever it takes, I'm going to get back.
Mistress,
I say quickly, an idea coming to me.
Do you think I could write to them? My father and Tien. Just let them know I'm well. Nothing more, I promise.
At first, it seems like she's going to say no. But with a half smile, she replies.
Of course, Lei. What a nice idea.
I'll make sure you're given paper and ink. I grin, forcing myself to remain dignified and not throw my arms around her in a giant bear hug.
I picture my father and Tien reading my letters together.
Even from the other side of the kingdom, they'll be able to touch something I've touched. Feel my presence in each indent on the paper. They'll know I'm safe. And always that I am thinking of them.
Make sure to bring your letters to me when they're done,
Mistress Iara instructs.
I'll give them to my most trusted messenger to deliver.
Of course. Thank you, Mistress. You don't know how much this means to me. She returns my smile, but just before she turns away, I notice something flutter across her eyes. The barest shadow of sadness. Perhaps it's all this talk about the past, about life before the palace. I recall what Mistress Iara said about waking up from dreams of her childhood, her once dye-stained hands delicate and bare, and comprehend that although she might have avoided answering my question about whether she misses her home, I am sure of what the answer would be anyway. I know what it means to dream about the past. To dream about things you have loved and lost.
9. Paper House is already busy when I wake the next day, the sunlit air bright with the sound of maids hurrying in the hallways, orders being called from room to room. Excitement carries through the air, an electric hum. It takes me back to festivals in our village, when every street would be draped with crimson banners during the 15 days of the new year, or lit with sparklers and firecrackers for spirit-warding ceremonies in the winter. Tonight, cities across the kingdom will be celebrating in our honor as we participate in the unveiling ceremony where the paper girls are officially presented to the court. I can still hardly believe that this year, that includes me. Lil is so excited about the ceremony, she barely pauses for a breath from the minute she comes to take me for my morning bath.
I haven't been able to visit my parents and tell them about becoming your maid yet, she chatters as I soak, her fluted deer ears quivering. They're not going to believe it. Mistress, you might even see them during the procession. I wish I could be with you. The look on their faces, if they knew.
I float my hands out, scooping the bubbles on the surface of the water. When was the last time you saw them?
Oh.
Though she's still smiling, her voice has a waver in it when she answers.
It's been quite long. Almost half a year.
I splash round.
Half a year? But they live here, right? In the palace.
Lil nods.
I lived with them in Mortal Court before I moved here, and they work in City Court, which is just south of here. I just don't get many days off. Not that I'm complaining, she says hurriedly. And the ones I do, I spend with them.
I have a little brother and sister, too. I try to bring them a few treats from the kitchens whenever I visit.
She cuts off, blanching.
Don't worry. If anyone notices, tell them it was me. The portions here are way too small. Lil's smile comes back, grateful, even though this sweet girl shouldn't have to worry about stealing a few bits of food to bring to her siblings. I hope you can see them soon, I add. She bows her head. Thank you, mistress.
I place my wet hand over hers, where she's holding the edge of the tub.
You know, I had a steel cast friend back in Cienzo too. She worked in my family's herb shop.
Really?
Lil's eyes widen. We were told casts don't ever work for ones below them outside the palace.
She blushes and goes on quickly, her head lowered.
Oh, I didn't mean that it's wrong for me to be working for you. It's a huge privilege, mistress. It's just... Mistress Iara told us it's an exception that the paper girls have demons as servants. She said the king himself requested it. Only steals, though.
She glances up at me from under thick lashes.
I'm sorry, I'm not Moon.
I almost laugh, the notion that I would prefer a moon cast for a maid, or just anyone other than her.
You're perfect, Lil, I tell her. And the beam of her grin is so luminous, it seems to wash the whole courtyard with gold.
Following tradition, each of us is dressed in silver for tonight's ceremony. Silver is a powerful color, a symbol of strength, success, wealth. Yet because of its closeness to white, the mourning color shared by all Ikaran cultures, it is sometimes thought to bring bad luck. When Lil tells me about this tradition, I understand the message it is sending to the kingdom. Support the king and you will be rewarded. Cross him and you will suffer. Because it's Lil's first time being a paper girl's maid, her preparations are overseen by one of the other maids. Chiho, a serious-looking steel-cast lizard girl. Human in appearance apart from the coating of sleek, pine-green scales along her bony arms and neck. Chiho dashes between rooms, trying to teach Lil while getting her own girl ready, until Lil suggests we get ready together. I can't remember which girl Chiho is a maid to, so when she appears in the doorway with Ren beside her, I stiffen. Though still in her bathrobe and only half made up, Ren looks striking. Her cheeks have been colored a deep plum shade that brings out the dark sheen of her eyes and lips, and her hair cascades over one shoulder in flowing waves. She picks up the hem of her bathrobe as she steps inside. My eyes are drawn to the movement, and I do a double take. Ren's feet are worn, their soles hard and calloused. They're more like my own feet. Worker's feet, not the delicate kind you'd expect from the pampered daughter of the Hanos. Catching me looking, she releases her robe, and the hem drops to the floor.
Right, Chiho says to Lil. Let's continue.
Ren avoids my gaze as she kneels in front of me. I fight the childish urge to shout at her, to make her look at me. I remember what Aoki told me about Ren being aware of people hating her. Well, she isn't exactly helping the matter, is she? It takes an hour for Chiho and Lil to finish with our faces. Coated with polish, my eyelids and lips are sticky. The first thing I do when they step back is lift a hand to rub my eyes, causing Lil to have a mini panic attack and assess closely for damage, even though I hadn't touched them yet.
Chiho circles me, making one final inspection.
Good, she says eventually, and Lil beams. My eyes cut to Ren, who still hasn't said anything all this time. As she gets up to leave, I lift my chin and blurt out brusquely.
Well, how do I look?
I want to take it back immediately. I sound petulant and stupid, and I'm not even sure why I care about her opinion. But Ren has already stopped. She glances over her shoulder, dark eyes under heavily glossed lids finally meeting mine.
Like you're not ready, she says bluntly, her face expressionless, before following Chiho out of the room.
Her words sting. I look away, my cheeks glowing. Lil leaves the room, returning a few minutes later with the silk-wrapped package.
Your dress, she announces almost reverently as she hands it to me. The royal tailors were given the results of your assessments and told to create unique pieces for each of you. It's meant to be a statement to the court about who you are, something to give the king an idea about what you're like.
Her eyes shine.
Go on, mistress. Open it.
Rolling my eyes at her excitement, I pull aside the folds of silk. There's the wink of metallic silver. Carefully, I lift the dress out and lay it on the floor.
It's the most exquisite dress I have ever seen.
Not that that's hard, I haven't seen many. But even including the dresses the other girls wore on the first night at the palace, this one outshines them all. Cut long and slender, sleeveless with a high collar, silver threads woven through, flicker like running water when they catch the light. The delicate silk fabric is almost sheer. A scattering of moonstones, opals, and diamonds wind along the hips and chest. I stare down at myself, my belly doing a low flop. Just a handful of these jewels would be enough to support my family for life. Lil lets out a squeal so high-pitched it almost shatters my eardrums.
Oh, it's so beautiful. Try it on, mistress.
Many awkward, wiggling movements later, the Chong Sam, as I know now this modern style of dress is called, is on. It fits perfectly, clinging to my frame like a second skin. Despite the jewels, the material is light, mere brushings of gossamer across my skin. The warmth of magic thrums in the fabric. Whatever enchantment has been placed on the dress also makes it glow. Every movement I make sends out scatters of silvery light, as pale as moonbeams. I raise a brow at Lil's expression. This is the first time you've not had anything to say. She giggles.
Better enjoy it, mistress. I don't know how long it'll last.
After a final once-over, we head through Paper House to its main entrance, where the procession will start. Though the dress fits perfectly, less perfect is my ability to move in it, and it takes me a while to get used to wearing something this form-fitting. Not to mention, it feels so expensive, I'm worried about damaging it. Every table corner glints threateningly. As a muffled buzz of voices and music outside grows louder, my heart thuds harder. Maids bow as I pass, some holding up good luck offerings of red flowers, others sprinkling salt in my path, a custom I've never seen before. We would never waste salt in my house like this. When we're almost at the entrance, I spot the familiar blaze of auburn hair.
Aoki,
I call, and she turns, breaking into a grin.
Lei, oh, you look...
Something shifts in her tone, a twist of envy. One hand fingers the collar of her own dress as her gaze travels slowly down mine.
You look amazing, I say quickly. What a beautiful Rukin.
I look it over appreciatively. The layered sheets of material are shimmery and light, decorated with patterns of leaves in thick brushstrokes. When I run my fingers over them, the leaves seem to ripple, swirling as if in a wind. More magic. She tucks her chin, lashes low. They say they're designed to reflect our personalities. It sounds silly, but as soon as I put it on,
I felt like I was home, like I have a part of the countryside with me. But you...
She reaches for my dress, then stops short.
You look like a queen.
Her words send a shudder through me. That's the last thing I want to look like. I think of Baba and Tien. What would they say if they saw me in this dress, my face and hair decorated even more elaborately than our entire village during New Year's celebrations? If I were a queen, then that would mean I would belong in the palace. And I don't. As Aoki and I walk down the last few corridors together, the sound of cheering grows so loud now, it vibrates in my ribcage. We step out onto the porch into sunlight and a clapping crowd. The streets around Paper House are packed with onlookers. My breath hitches. I've never been in the midst of so many people, let alone steel and moon casts all packed together. And even though their applause and shouts are friendly, the sheer number of them makes me uneasy. Along one of the streets, the crowd is parting to let through a train of ornate carriages carried by muscled oryx-form demons in red and black robes, the king's colors. Aoki nudges me excitedly as they advance. Wind flutters the ribbons draped over their open sides. Every step they take makes the bells hanging from their horns sing. They come to a stop in front of Paper House. Madam Himura moves forward, shouting to be heard over the noise.
Presenting Mistress Aoki G of Shomu.
A servant comes to take Aoki to her carriage. She gives me a quick look, her jade stone eyes gleaming, whether from excitement or fear I can't tell, and her fingers brush before she's led away. Next, Madame Himura calls Blue, then Chenna. All too soon, it's my turn. I stumble forward, head low against the stare of the crowd. With a bow, the oryx drop to their knees. A servant helps me up into the lowered palanquin. The interior reminds me of the carriage I traveled in with General Yu, with its plush, perfumed cushions and elegant wood paneling. As I settle on the bench, my breath grows tighter. That carriage stole me away from my home. What kind of life am I about to be led into with this journey? In this beautiful Cheongsam, being carried on the backs of demons, I feel like a dish being served for the king's dinner, and a shiver runs down my spine. Just when will he choose to devour me? 10. My view is obstructed by the long sashes hanging over the palanquin's open sides, so this is how I see the palace properly for the first time. In snatched glimpses, the blur of movement and color. The lowering sun tints everything in a golden haze. It looks dreamlike, and feels it too, as though I were looking out through someone else's eyes. I'm about to become a paper girl. The concept is still ridiculous and ungraspable, even though here I am, sheathed in silver, hundreds of humans and demons watching my carriage pass, craning for one look at my face. Yesterday, Mistress Iara showed us a map of the palace. I picture it now, trying to keep track of where we're going. I haven't forgotten about finding my mother, and maybe I'll see something that will give me a clue as to where she might be. The palace grounds are arranged in a grid-like system, divided into courts which are further separated into two areas, the outer courts, where all the daily services, work, and residential areas are, and the private inner courts, where only those of certain positions are allowed. Women's court is in the northeast block of the palace, in the outer courts. We first travel south, passing through City Court, a vast bustling area of trade, markets, and restaurants. Then we head west through Ceremony Court, the square behind the main gates
where I arrived with the general, and on to Industry Court, with its smoking forges and leather tanning houses. Next, we move up the west side of the palace. We pass through Mortal Court, Lil's family's home, another city-like area where the maids, servants, and low-level government officials live, and then Military Court, home to the training grounds and army barracks. There are two areas in the outer courts we don't visit. At the northwest tip of the palace, Ghost Court is the official burial grounds. It would be bad luck to pass through such a place on a night of celebration. We also avoid Temple Court, which is within the exterior walls of the palace itself. The royal shamans must never be disturbed. Only with the king's permission can one enter their holy grounds. At one point, though, when we take a perimeter road through one of the courts that takes us right up to the wall, a warm, prickly sensation ripples across my body, the thrum of magic imbued in my dress, seeming to shiver and rustle in response. Night has fallen by the time we finally arrive at the inner courts. At once, the crowds thin out. It's still busy, with every court official and their servants out to greet us, but the grounds here are more spacious, so the effect is of a sudden dampening, like a thick fog pillowing the world. The quiet comes as a shock after the jubilant atmosphere of the outer courts, and suddenly I miss the noise and chaos. I watch the darkening grounds through the window with a growing sense of unease, my tongue padded and dry in my mouth. We're almost there. The landscape of the inner courts is a mix of lantern-lit streets, elegant pearl-white squares, and manicured gardens, the perfume of flowers cloying in the air. Moonlight reflects off a sweeping crescent of water that loops in and out of sight as we travel. The River of Infinity. It flows in a figure eight through Royal Court, the area at the heart of the palace, designed to bring the heaven's fortune on the king. The last part of our journey is marked when we pass over the centralmost point of the river, where the four curves meet. A gilded bridge arches over the water, lined with onlookers. They toss red blossoms at us, the petals catching in the wind and swirling around our carriages like a blood-drenched snowstorm. Heaven's blessings! May the gods smile down upon you. Their words are well-meaning, but much less exuberant than those of the outer courts. The closeness of all these demons makes me press back from the window. We're almost over the bridge, when there's the thud of something ramming the carriage. I fling out my arms as it jerks to the left. Another thud. This time, the carriage lurches sideways, almost tipping over. I smash into the side, fingers scrabbling for hold just in time. A few seconds later, and I would have fallen through the open side. As the oryx right the carriage, I steady myself, rubbing my right shoulder where it hit the wood. Yells and shouts are coming from outside. Still cradling my shoulder, I cross the floor and peer out through the fluttering ribbons. And gasp. A human. Paper cast, her furless, scaleless, clawless body, standing out against the otherness of the demons all around, is being pinned to the floor by two guards. Her robes are thin and worn. Servants' clothes. Paper cast servants aren't allowed in the inner courts. She must have snuck in somehow. Just then, she lifts her head and her eyes meet. I don't know what I was expecting. That they'd be filled with compassion, maybe? A kindred connection from one human to another? But instead, her look is fire. Darja, she shrieks. Flickering lantern light distorts her face, making her mouth seem too wide, her cheeks sunk in hollows. Dirty sluts, you shame us all! Above her, A guard lifts a club. I look away, but not quickly enough. The heavy crunch rings in my ears, the accusatory glare in her eyes just before the club was brought down on her skull shimmers on the back of my eyelids, a ghostly afterimage. Lowering my lashes, I hover my fingers at my chest, then turn them outwards with my thumbs crossed. The sky gods salute for a newly departed soul.
Mistress, are you all right?
I jolt as a horned face, part rhino, skin thick like hide, appears through the ribbons. I open my mouth a few times before finding my voice.
Yes.
Apologies for the disruption. You will be continuing on your way now. The guard bows.
Wait,
I say as he turns to leave. He looks round, and I go on.
The woman. Why was she?
His expression doesn't change.
Why was she killed?
I swallow.
Yes.
She was a slave. She wasn't permitted to be in the inner courts, and she posed a threat to the king's property. It takes me a moment to realize he means me.
But you could have arrested her. You didn't have to kill her.
Guards are permitted to execute paper casts on the spot.
The leathery skin of his forehead wrinkles.
Is that all, mistress?
The tone of his voice makes me stiffen. He says it so easily, so bluntly, as though it weren't anything at all.
Mistress, he repeats in my silence, is that all?
I go to nod, then change it to shake at the memory of the searing look in her eyes.
The woman, she called me something. Tharja.
What does it mean?
He scowls at the word. It's an ugly expression.
For what?
Traitor, he says, and lowers his hand, ducking his head out of the carriage, the ribbons fluttering back into place.
Tharja. The word haunts me as our procession starts back up. How easily the guard took the woman's life. Just the arc of a muscled arm. She wasn't that much older than my mother when she was stolen. And I get a flash of a paper cast face. Mama's this time. Mouth wide with terror as she is pinned down by a demon guard. I've been so focused on the thought that all she needed was to survive the journey here that I didn't consider how difficult it might be for her to survive once she arrived. 10 minutes later, my stomach is still churning when we pass through a set of tall gates into a barren plaza. A single road cuts down the center. Ahead looms a grand fortress, carved from flecked rock, dark as a raven's coat. Banners marked with the king's bull skull symbol snap in the wind. On every balcony and along the base of the building, guards stand watch, weapons at the ready. The quiet is uneasy, and the hooffall of the oryx demons echoes through the desolate square, my own pulse matching the rhythm and even their weight. Each beat so heavy and terse, it's like my heart is clamping around a stone. As we make our approach, I flex my fingers, trying to bring blood back to them. My muscles are as frozen as the rock of the royal palace looks. Our procession comes to a stop at the bottom of a grand set of marble stairs, leading up to a high vaulted entranceway. At first, everything is still. Then a band of gold unfurls itself from the entranceway. In one luxurious sweep, it rolls down the staircase, viscous and fluid, like some kind of charmed waterfall. And sure enough, I pick up the telltale vibration of magic in the air. The door of my carriage swings open. Mistress Lei Ji, greets a servant, holding out a hand to help me down. The golden spill has painted the ground around the carriages in a shimmering metallic carpet. As my feet meet the floor, I look down to see ripples flowing out around me. But despite the beauty of it,
I'm still reeling from what just happened on the bridge. And I follow the rest of the girls up the stairs, eyes trained on my feet to avoid the stares of the guards. The world seems to grow even quieter when we enter the palace. But maybe I'm imagining it. The hush that sinks over us, reverent almost. As we march, I take in our surroundings in silent awe. There are echoing halls and narrow corridors, indoor gardens with magical ceilings that mimic the night sky, long staircases that wind steeply from floor to floor. Everything is carved out of the same black stone as the exterior, and though undeniably beautiful, it gives the place a clammy, imposing feel, like a mausoleum. I think of the paper girls who came before me, the dreams of theirs that might have died within these very walls. We have been walking for over 20 minutes when we are finally told to stop. A vaulted archway looms before us, the room beyond hidden by a heavy black curtain. We're still in a line ordered by our names. In front of me, Chenna's thick hair falls down in its usual braid, though tonight it has been threaded with tiny silver flowers that make it look as if she'd been dancing between the galaxies, catching stars. Her shoulders rise and drop with shallow breaths. I'm about to step forward, offer some words of comfort, when there's a groan behind me.
"Oh, gods,"
Mariko moans.
"I think I'm going to be sick."
I pivot round to find her doubled over, her face white. "Take a deep inhale," I say, laying a hand on her arm, but she shoves me away.
"I don't need the help of a peasant," she snaps.
I draw back. "Fine, then." I'm about to turn away when over Mariko's bowed head, Ren catches my gaze. I freeze. She looks so astonishing, it's almost unreal, as though she'd slipped out of a painting, perfectly formed, a thing of beauty, of art, of bright, vivid life in this cold, still place. The design of her Changsam is the exact opposite of mine. Where the collar of mine is high, hers runs low, exposing the deep shadow of her cleavage. My dress has a slit up the side. Hers is tight all the way down her legs, emphasizing their length and muscled shape. Unlike my sheer fabric, hers is a dark gunmetal silver, dangerous and enticing, evocative of armor. Faintly, I remember what Lil said about our dresses representing our personalities. Underneath my wonder at her beauty, curiosity stirs. As usual, Ren is the one to break eye contact. But to my surprise, she does so to lean forward to speak into Mariko's ear. "I don't know about you," she murmurs, "but I have never seen a peasant who looked like that." She looks up at me, a half-smile touching her lips. "Now, you look ready," she says, just as a gong sounds from beyond the archway. I whip back round to see the curtain floating aside.
"Heavenly Master and honorable members of the court," a magnified voice announces from the room beyond. "Presenting this year's Paper Girls."
In front of me, Chenna straightens, rolling her shoulders back. I follow her resolve, releasing a long exhale to steady myself as best as I can, despite the spike of my pulse, as one by one, we step through the archway. We emerge into a columned hall, deep and cavern-like, draped with garlands of vermilion silk. The walls look hollowed out of a marble cave. Rows of sheer steps on all sides lead down to a sunken pool. Ink-black water glitters with the reflection of lanterns overhead. From balconies ringing the room, hundreds of demon faces leer down at us. Our steps echo
as we fan out in a row at the top of the steps, and I find it difficult to move, as if the expectant hush of the watching crowd had a weight, a solidity that thickens the atmosphere, lends an extra tug to gravity just here in this hall. At first I keep my eyes low, trained on the floor, but something soon pulls their attention. Something draws them down the steps across the pool and to the podium on the far side. And I know before I see him what, or rather, who it will be. The Demon King. Lounging almost on his marbled gold throne. Or at least there is something casual in the way he occupies it. Some smug, almost irreverent quality to the way he sits. Hips sloped a little too low, arms slung over the sides, head tilted back just enough to make it seem as if he were looking down at us, even though we are much higher up the steps. This is the first thing about him that surprises me. The king's pose is particularly at odds with the formal, straight-backed stances of the three soldiers flanking him. A gray wolf man, a huge moss-colored crocodile man, and a white fox female, all mooncast. Also unexpected is how slender he is, particularly in comparison with the crocodile demon who towers behind the throne. The king's muscles are lean, roped, a bull's strength bound through manlike limbs and hidden under layered black robes with gold trim. In a fight between him and his crocodile guard, I wouldn't rate the king's chances very high. Except, there is an energy about him, coiled and alert, a magnetic pull that commands attention and power. Ice-blue eyes watch from under long lashes. Above his ears, thick horns unwind, etched with grooves inlaid with gold. And as I take in his face from a distance, there is a third thing that surprises me. The king is handsome. I was expecting an old king, some weary, war-torn bull. But he looks young, not far past his teens. There's an elegance to his face. Whereas General Yu's was an ugly clash of imposing bull features, the king's face is long, almost delicate in shape, with a defined jaw and wide, graceful mouth, a cupid's bow peeking perfectly in its middle. A lazy smile sharpens into a grin. The king leans forward, lantern light lending his walnut coat a glossy sheen. "My new paper girls," he drawls. "Welcome." His voice is deep, heavy as night. Quickly, we drop to the floor in low bows. The marble is cool against my palms. I feel the king's gaze upon us, like a touch, and keep my head down, breathing hard.
"Presenting Mistress Aokiji of Shomu," comes the announcer's voice.
There's the sound of Aoki getting to her feet, her tentative footsteps. Then, the unmistakable swish of water as she enters the pool. Mistress Iara told us that the water is part of the ritual, symbolic of purifying our bodies before we meet the king. It's been enchanted, so it won't affect our appearance. A short while later, Aoki's wavering voice rings out with the greeting Mistress Iara taught us.
"How sweet," comes the sound of the king's voice, quieter now but still heavy and deep. "What a cute nose." I grind my teeth at his description of her. He makes it sound as if she were a toy, a plaything for him to toss aside once he grows bored. Which is exactly what she is, I remind myself, pressing my fingertips firmer against the cold stone. What we all are. The king takes more time with Blue, who was called next, and with Chenna, until all too soon,
The announcer sings, "Presenting Mistress Lei Ji of Xianzhou." I get to my feet.